"By land, then?" Karen asked us. Her voice sounded strained. "Yes, perhaps up near Elbergen." "So far up country?" "The price is right, and there's a beautiful garden. Mansfield loves a good garden."
"That I do."
He smiled and got up to pour brandy for us from a crystal decanter, looking at home with Karen's lovely things. "I'll just go and see about Dennis. He probably needs a drink."
"You're well situated now, aren't you?" Karen said when he'd gone.
I could feel something new in her gaze. Maybe an unspoken question about whether my marriage to Mansfield was the real article or a sham. Whatever it meant, it made me uncomfortable.
"You look awfully well."
"It's the pearls," I said. "You've worn pearls before."
She meant when I'd been with Frank Greswold. Not that she would ever have had the bad taste to mention it. But surely she could see that Mansfield wasn't just any man ready to pay my way. He wasn't a sponsor, cocky's terrible word, but my husband. The dog whimpered in a dream at Karen's feet, flinching and twitching her paws.
"We strike such dark bargains for love, don't we?"
"Do we?" I thought, as Karen settled the hound with one hand, like a mother and her babe. But I didn't answer her. Chapter 49. 120 miles north of Nairobi, Elbergen was cool in the morning, with sparkling crisp skies and high, white flat-bottomed clouds. After a rain, mist settled in rifts along the hillsides, and I would take all of it in, walking to gallops in the early mornings, reminding myself that none of it was borrowed or tainted, that no one could try to ruin it for me or take it away. Our farm was called Melela, with a house that stood on stilts, dripping with blue, bougainvillea, and flame vine. Purple passion fruit covered the back fence, and morning glories heaped over the veranda and arbor. Everywhere you looked, there was a new splash of color, and the air smelled alive. I had a heavy brass bell installed outside the main stable door, not long after we moved in, and Ruta rang it to wake the farm every morning before dawn, as our head groom, Wayanina, had once done at Green Hills. Ruta and his family had a cottage near the stables, and he had his own office next to mine, though usually we found ourselves at the same desk, staring into the same ledger, side by side. "What if we brought Klut back from Cape Town to train for us?" I asked Mansfield in bed one night. I had been thinking about it for weeks, growing more excited by the idea and what it would mean. Money had kept my father away, and also the tarnishing of his reputation. But I was in a position to offer him a job and a prestigious place in the colony, one worthy of him and his talents.
"Would he consider an offer?"
"I think so, if it was sweet enough."
"With two clutterbucks in one stable, I don't think the rest of Kenya could touch us."
"You don't know how happy that would make me. How right this feels." I sent off a cable immediately, and before 2 months passed, I had my father back. He'd aged, and his hair had grown grey and thin, his face more careworn, but the very sight of him seemed to heal something in me. I had been so young when he left, hopelessly overwhelmed by my marriage and the terrible loss of the farm. Nearly 8 years had passed, and more heartbreak than I could properly chart for him, or even myself. But there wasn't any need to tell him my sad stories, or even the happy ones. I only wanted to stand by him at the paddock gate, and watch one of our stallions run for all he was worth. To work by his side for a common goal. To be his daughter again. Yes, that would do it. Emma looked older too, of course,
and she seemed subdued, if not any softer. But I found she didn't unsettle me as she used to. I'd become the mistress of a household. She was our guest at Malayla, so what did it matter if she found me too coarse or headstrong now? Her opinion didn't mean as much as my own, or Mansfield's. As it turned out, Mansfield and Emma got on well. They both liked gardening, and soon could be seen kneeling together in domed sun hats, talking about root fungus or leaf blight, while I escaped to the stable where I belonged. "What was Cape Town like?" I asked my father, on one of the first mornings he was back. We leaned against the fencing along our gallops, watching one of our grooms exercise Clemency, a pretty new filly.
"Hot."
He kicked dust from his boots, squinting into the flaring sun.
"Competitive, too. The winds didn't come often."
"If we hadn't asked you back, would you have stayed?"
"I suppose so. I'm glad to be here, though. This is grand."
As ever, my father hoarded his words and his feelings, but I didn't care. I knew he was proud of me, and how far I'd come. I could feel it as we stood side by side, looking out over the green bowl of the spreading valley. "It's the same view that we had in Najoro," I told him. "A little further north, but everything else is the same."
"I suppose it is," he said. "You've done well for yourself."
"After a fashion. It hasn't always been easy."
"I know."
In his look were all the years we'd spent apart, the decisions we'd made, the difficult past we didn't need to name. All of it rolled up and pushed away like a heavy stone, as he sighed once and said,
"Shall we get to work then?"
In short order, the name, Mrs. Beryl Markham, began to appear in the racing columns, as a trainer and as an owner, too. That was utterly new. Clut and I planned and schemed, building our operation by buying up the progeny of horses from the old farm at Njoro, animals that he'd overseen the beginnings of. It was a wonderful feeling to reclaim and realize seeds sown way back. There was a rightness, too, to the evenings when all our heads would cluster over the thick black stud book, dreaming of greatness, daring to predict the future, Klutz and Reuter's and Mansfield's and mine. Every morning, even before the gallop started, I rode messenger boy. I went off alone with him, though this made Mansfield nervous. Messenger boy wasn't just any animal. He didn't trust me yet. Anyone could see that in the bold swing of his head, and in the way he glared at the grooms who dared to touch him. He knew he was a king. Who were we? One morning, I was only across the yard before messenger boy spooked. Whatever it was, I never saw it, only felt the muscular tremor as he bucked, twisting sharply sideways. Even startled, I sat him, but he wouldn't settle. I weathered three more violent twists before he sheered along the cedarwood fencing and peeled me off forcibly. Thankfully, I landed on the other side of the fence. Otherwise, he might have stamped me to death without even trying. It took four grooms to restrain him. My nose and chin streamed blood, so I left the grooms to care for him and went into the house to rinse and bandage myself. My hip ached, and I knew I'd have a massive bruise there. But it was Mansfield I really needed to worry about. "My God, Beryl," he said the moment he caught sight of me. "What if it killed you?" "It wasn't that bad. Really, I've fallen off horses all my life." "He's too much of a loose cannon, that one. What if he really did hurt you? I know you want to be the one to tame him, but can that be worth the risk?" "You think it's pride keeping me on messenger boy? Isn't it? This is what I'm best at. I know what he can be and how to get him there. I can see it, and I've no intention of giving up on him." "All right. But why does it have to be you? School one of the grooms, or even Ruta?
But it's my work. I really can manage him, Mansfield. And I will.
He stormed away unhappily, while I finished tending to my wounds. When I returned to the barn, the grooms had Messenger Boy hobbled and tied between two thick posts. They'd hooded him, and his eyes looked wild and murderous. "You'll never tame me," is what they said. I could have ordered the grooms to free him, but I did it myself instead, working to be quiet in all my movements, while they looked on anxiously. My father didn't challenge me, and neither did Ruta, but they both trailed me at a distance while I returned Messenger Boy to his loose box. All the way there the horse stamped warningly and strained hard against the lead, and even when he was behind the stall door, he paced a tight line, whirling and glaring, challenging me. He seemed arrogant and full of hatred, but I guessed that beneath it all was sharp fear and self-protection. He didn't want me to change him or make him something he wasn't. He wouldn't be coerced into giving himself away.
"You're going to mount him again," I heard Mansfield say. He'd been watching from the house and had come into the stable without my knowing it.
"Tomorrow I will. He's still angry with me today."
"Why aren't you angry with him? Honestly, Beryl, it's almost as if you want him to hurt you."
"That's absurd. I just don't blame him for following his nature."
"And my feelings don't count?"
"Of course they do. But I have to get on with his training. This really is what farm life is about, Mansfield. It's not all window dressing and pretty flower pots."
With that, he stormed off again, and it was several days before I could convince him that I really wasn't just being obstinate, but following my nature too, because I had to. Nothing else felt quite right.
"I didn't think it would be so hard to watch you work," he confessed, after his mood had softened.
"What about when we have children one day?
Surely you'll slow down then."
"I don't see why I should. It was good for me to grow up on a farm. It made me."
"I suppose I'm more conventional than I thought," he said.
"And more stubborn, even than you warned me about." Then I kissed him, wanting to make up. In March, Mansfield and I went into Nairobi and found everyone at the club talking about Maya Carberry. Just 2 days before, JC's beautiful young wife had been giving a flying lesson to a young student, Dudley Cowie, when her plane spun in at low altitude, crashing at the edge of the Ngong Road, near Nairobi's Dagoretti airfield. Dudley's twin brother, Mervyn, had just finished his own lesson and saw everything. The impact and explosion, the wall of flames that left nothing identifiable of either victim. Dudley was only 22. Maya was 24. And had left behind a 3-year-old daughter, Juanita. J.C. was with the child now, at the Carberry's farm in Nyeri, apparently too heartsick to speak to anyone, or even get out of bed. When we ran into Dennis and Karen at the club, they both seemed stunned. They were also worried about what could be done for the family.
"That poor girl will never know her mother," Karen said. She tugged worriedly on the cotton shawl around her shoulders. "She won't even remember her, will she?"
"That might be the biggest blessing," Dennis replied grimly. "It's J.C. who's in real trouble."
"I'm surprised she wanted to fly when she had so much to live for, so many people counting on her," Mansfield said, looking at me directly, as if I could possibly miss his meaning. But I wasn't going to row with him on such a sad day. Our small tensions were hardly the point.
"Aeroplanes might be safer than automobiles," Dennis said. "I don't think she saw flying as terribly rash."
"Your views aren't really the standard, Dennis,"
Mansfield answered flatly. Tell me, are you off down the Nile again soon?
Not exactly, Dennis said.
You haven't heard then, Karen said. Elbergen is far north, isn't it?
What she meant, we soon learned, was that a royal visit was in the making. The heir to the throne, Edward, Prince of Wales, was set to visit Kenya in late September with his brother, Henry, Duke of Gloucester. Dennis had been charged to take them hunting.
A royal safari? I asked.
A royal fiasco, most likely. You've no idea the number of preparations.
It's the opportunity of a lifetime, Karen said sharply. Her shawl was crimson and deep blue, with threads in a pattern that overlapped. She held it firmly in front of her chest, like a shield.
If you really don't want the work, give it to Braw instead.
Mansfield plucked at an invisible bit of lint on his trousers, still clearly disturbed by the news about Maya Carberry. Dennis had his mouth set. Karen was feeling spurned in some way I could only guess at, until Mansfield and Dennis went inside to book us a table for lunch.
It's one of the most significant moments in our history, and he won't take it seriously.
He's never liked fuss or pomp, I said. I'm guessing there are 10 different committees or subcommittees who'll want to sort every detail down to the commode.
It's not just the safari that matters. It's the social event of the decade, perhaps the century.
You know he's never going to care about parties.
But I'd missed the larger point.
Braw is newly remarried. I always worried there would be another Baroness Blixen, and it's happening at the direst moment. Divorced women aren't going to be welcome at Government House for the principal fating. You see how impossible it all is.
She clenched and unclenched her hands. Her knuckles were white. You want Dennis to marry you, I said quietly, finally putting it all together.
He refuses.
She laughed icily, a terrible sound.
If he won't now, for this, for me, he never will.
Chapter 50. For the next several months, I tried to think only about our horses, particularly Messenger Boy, who seemed to be resisting me a little less each day. No one would have called him tame, but some mornings when I rode him, I felt something in the rounded smoothness of his back that felt very nearly like forbearance. He might not have liked me yet, or even accepted me, but I was beginning to think he understood what I wanted from him, and that he might soon begin to want those things for himself. One morning, I had just handed Messenger Boy to his groom for cooling down, when I met Emma in a sun hat as wide as a parasol.
"Are you feeling well?"
she asked, a strange look on her face. So like Emma, she hadn't even said good morning.
"Of course," I told her.
But that night, when Mansfield was away in town on errands, I felt a rocking wave of nausea and barely made it out of bed before I vomited. When Mansfield came home, he found me bent in two on the floor, too weak to stand.
"Should we go and see the doctor in town?" he fretted.
"No. It's just a touch of something I ate. I only need to lie down." He got me back to bed, draped cool cloths over my forehead, and pulled the curtains closed so I could rest. But after he planted a sweet kiss in my palm and backed out of the room, I stared at the wall for a long time, thinking. I was pregnant, of course. The feeling was the same as it had been before, in London. Somehow Emma had suspected, before I had come to the truth myself. I knew I needed to tell Mansfield, but after the business with Messenger Boy, and the way he had reacted to Maya Carberry's death, I was terrified to bring it up. The pregnancy would only intensify his concerns about me. That was clear. What if he wanted not just to swaddle me, but to curb me,
What then?
While I was still stuck in a cycle of worry and doubt, Mansfield finally guessed.
Aren't you happy, darling?
He clasped my hands and gazed into my eyes.
We're just getting started here, I tried to explain. There's so much to do to make a farm run smoothly and get the horses in line.
How terrible would it really be to take a little time off? When you're ready to get back to it, the horses will be here.
We were lying in our bed in the dark. His white pajama shirt seemed to float and jump in front of my eyes.
I don't want to stop working, Mansfield. Please don't ask me to.
Surely you'll stop riding, at least until the baby is born. You have to take care of yourself.
This is how I take care of myself, don't you see? If we have this baby, I'll need to do my work just as before. I don't know any other way to live.
If we have this baby?
He pulled back and his eyes hardened.
Surely there's no question.
I backpedaled. I'm only afraid of how things will change.
They will, of course. We're talking about a child, Beryl. Some dear small boy or girl who will look to us for everything.
His voice had taken on an intensity that sent me spinning. He didn't seem to understand that the very idea of throwing off the life I knew best for any other terrified me. There were women who never thought twice about giving themselves over to domestic life, the needs of their husbands and children. Some actually craved that role, but I'd never seen more than a hint of this sort of home life. Could I even do it?
You'll learn to be a good mother, he said, after I'd been silent for a long time. People can learn all sorts of things.
I hope you're right. I closed my eyes and lay my hand on his chest, feeling along the slick buttons of his shirt and the perfect piped edge of the cotton. The hem made so carefully and so well, it wouldn't, couldn't, ever unravel.
Chapter 51. The whole world would read about the royal visit. How the train station in Nairobi was festooned with roses and painted welcome banners. Hundreds of flapping flags. Thousands of people from every possible race in peacock-hued ceremonial robes and headdresses, fezzes and toques and velvet slippers. Our new governor, Sir Edward Grigg, bellowed his speech into a megaphone before the two young princes were whisked away to Government House on the hill. For the first of many grand fetes and supper parties and sweeping exclusive balls. For a month, every white woman within 100 miles had been practicing her curtsy and wringing her hands over what to wear. It was a lottery of entitlement. All the honourables and baronets and first or third earls of where have you rolled out in their finest form. I was 4 months pregnant, and too distracted to be concerned about any of it. And I also wasn't nearly ready to share my news with others. To buy time, I'd begun to wear loose blouses and forgiving skirts. Me, who was never out of slacks. I saw it as my only solution, along with hiding out as much as possible. But Mansfield was insisting we be present for everything.
Let's just tell people, darling. They'll all know soon enough, anyway.
I know, but it just seems so personal.
What?
His forehead wrinkled.
It's happy news, silly.
Can't you go to the parties alone? I don't feel like myself.
You can't honestly think of begging off. It's an honor to be invited, Beryl.
You're sounding like Karen.
Am I?
He gave me a strange look.
I suppose that must mean you sound like Finch Hatton.
What? I met his eyes. What are you suggesting?
Nothing,
he said coolly, and strode away. In the end, I went along to keep the peace. For the first elaborate dinner, Prince Henry was seated to my left.
Down the far end sat Edward, Albert, Christian, George, Andrew, Patrick, David, dashing heir to the monarchy. Informally, he was called David, and his brother Henry, Duke of Gloucester, was Harry, and both were keen to be shown a good time.
"I saw you riding to hounds in Leicestershire last year," Harry said to me over bowls of chilled lemon soup.
He meant during our stay in Swiftston with Mansfield's mother, though there hadn't been a formal introduction. He was taller and darker than his brother David, and only slightly less handsome.
"You look marvellous on a horse, particularly in slacks. I think all women should wear slacks."
"Coco Chanel might be interested to hear you say it,"
the very done-up Lady Grig chimed in from Harry's elbow, trying to insert herself. Harry ignored her.
"You nearly caused a riot that day at Melton," he said. "That was my favourite part."
I couldn't help but smile. Yes, it seems High Leicestershire had never seen a woman astride a horse instead of side-saddle.
"So refreshing to see the old birds get a shock. But they stopped talking as soon as they saw you take the fences so boldly. A beautiful woman with a good seat is her own argument."
I thanked him, laughing, while Lady Grig craned our way again. She was the dignified wife of our governor, and yet there, with Prince Harry, she was transfixed by every word we were saying. I had the feeling she thought he was flirting with me. It was possible he was.
"Maybe you could break away before the safari and see our horses up in Elbergen," I suggested. "We have the best bloodstock around."
"Sounds wonderful."
He smiled easily beneath his clipped dark brown moustache. He had grey eyes, and they looked at me clearly.
"If it were up to me, we wouldn't hunt at all. David's the one who wants to bag a lion. I'd rather ride to the top of the highest hill I can find and see everything, in every direction."
"Then do it," I said. "Who'd stop you?"
"You'd think that, wouldn't you? But I don't run the show here. I'm not much more than window dressing, really."
"You're a prince."
"I'm down the line," he smiled. "It's fine by me, really. Poor David's got his head in the noose."
"Well, even if you don't care for hunting, you've found the right fellow to take you out."
"Finch Hatton, yes, he seems a splendid fellow."
"He's the very best there is." I glanced down to where Dennis sat near Prince David, both of them flanked by admirers. Karen hadn't been invited, as she'd suspected. There would be hell to pay for Dennis when he finally returned to Bogani, though who knew when that would be. He'd been so preoccupied by safari preparations that I hadn't seen him, even briefly, in months. In some respects, Dennis and I were both in a period of suspension. There was no way this safari wouldn't change his life. The time and privacy he craved would be swallowed up by his new notoriety, and I knew some part of him dreaded it, the purest part, which only wanted to live simply, by his own code. How I understood that. Within a very short time, my belly would grow unmistakably round, and my breasts tighten and swell. My body would transform first, and then everything else would follow. I still cared for Mansfield, but I also felt as if I'd boarded a train meant for one place that was now irrevocably going somewhere else entirely. The whole situation made me feel desperate. With a stirring of passionate violins, the string quartet began to play Schubert.
"Tell me, do you dance, Harry?" I asked him.
"Like a fool."
"Wonderful," I said. "Save one for me." The next week, David and Harry came up to Mailela, as I'd suggested, and raced on our exercise track. It wasn't much as races went. David was compact and athletic-looking, but he wasn't a very able rider. He sat Cambrian, and Harry sat Clemency, and for 5 furlongs the brothers were neck and neck,
while an entire entourage cheered them on. Cambrian was the much better racer. He was undefeated, in fact, until that day.
"You're nice not to say how bloody awful I am," David said as we walked back to the paddock, his blue eyes full of charisma.
All along the fence, eligible women strained in a pose, ready to kill or drop their knickers for a whiff of his attention.
"You were lovely," I laughed. "Well, the stallion was, in any case."
"Who's this fellow?" he asked when we came near Messenger Boy. "Now there's a fine animal."
"He's had a bit of a check at history, but he's starting to come round. Would you like to see him run?"
"I'll say."
I had one of the grooms ready Messenger Boy for me, thinking not just that he would make a magnificent impression on the prince, but also that it was a fitting opportunity to show Mansfield that I meant to keep handling our animals as before. It was probably obstinate of me, but I imagined I could easily explain how David had insisted on seeing Messenger Boy to his fullest advantage. When that day was over, though, and the last vestiges of the entourage had trickled away, Mansfield let me know how unhappy I'd made him.
"You're deliberately trying to put this child at risk, Beryl, and embarrassing me besides. They're famous playboys, both of them, and no one could have missed your flirtation."
"Don't be silly. I was only being friendly, and everyone knows I'm married."
"Marriage hasn't exactly kept you out of trouble before."
I felt slapped.
"If you're angry about the horse, say that. Don't try to rub my nose in the past."
"You are being willful about the riding, no doubt, but you also seem to have no idea of how you're prompting gossip."
"You're exaggerating. My mother reads every word of the society columns, Beryl. I would die if even a whisper of scandal made its way home. You know how difficult she is."
"Then why bow and scrape to mollify her?
Why deliberately fuel gossip and speculation?"
He bit down hard on his lower lip, as he often did when he was angry.
"I think we should go back to England until the baby is born," he went on. "It's a much safer place to be for many reasons."
"Why travel so far?" I bristled. "What would I do there?"
"Take care of yourself, for a start. Be my wife."
"Are you doubting that I love you on top of everything else?"
"You do care, I think, as much as you can. But sometimes I wonder if you're still waiting for Finch Hatton."
"Dennis, why are you saying all of this now?"
"I don't know. It almost seems as if we've been playing a kind of game lately."
He looked at me closely.
"Have we, Beryl?"
"Of course not," I said firmly. But later, as I tried to sleep, I felt a surge of guilt and awareness. I wasn't trying to toy with Mansfield exactly, but I had been flirting with the princes. In a way, I couldn't help myself. It felt marvelous to smile, and make Harry smile too, or to walk off in a particular way, and know that David's eyes were on me. It was childish, and also futile, but for those moments I could believe I was free-spirited and alluring again, as if I still had some measure of control in the world. How had Mansfield and I come to a standoff so quickly? I wondered. We'd started off well, committed to being staunch allies and friends. It hadn't been perfect, but now this pregnancy was pressing us into separate corners. I had absolutely no desire to go to England to placate him. But what was the alternative? If things fell apart between us now, I'd be alone with a child to care for. I could also possibly lose the farm, and that seemed out of the question. Like it or not, I would have to bend.
Chapter 52. The safari was set to depart, and Karen was throwing a royal dinner Dennis had helped her secure, no doubt a peacekeeping concession.
She couldn't go to Government House because of social protocol, but the princes could very well come to her. She made it worth their while, too, serving an incomparable meal with so many courses and small delicacies, I quickly lost count. There was ham, poached in champagne, with tiny jewel-like strawberries, and tart, plump pomegranate seeds, a mushroom croustade with truffles and cream. When Karen's cook, Carmante, came in bearing the dessert, a fat and perfectly browned rum baba, I thought he might float away with pride. I watched Karen closely, too, certain she must be feeling this evening as one of her finest moments. But under the powder and jet-black coal, her eyes were lined and exhausted-looking. The safari plan had evolved, and Blix was now going along too, as Dennis's right-hand man. One safari had turned into several, beginning with a foray into Uganda, with other later trips into Tanganyika, and Cocky had been invited to go along as Blix's wife, and also safari hostess, making sure the water was hot for baths at the end of the day, and that Dr. Turvey had wired in prescriptions for plenty of gin. Karen was left in the lurch, and she was livid about it, I soon learned. The culmination of the evening was a Kikuyu Ngoma, the largest of these I had ever seen. Several thousand dancers gathered from tribes all over the area, their chiefs joining forces to give the princes a picture they'd never forget. The central bonfire licked up at the sky. Several smaller blazes encircled it, like brilliant spokes around a gleaming hub. The drum music rose and fell in great rippling crescendos, while male and female dancers flung themselves rhythmically in moves too ancient and complex ever to chart. I watched it all, remembering the Ngomas of my childhood, when Kibiyi and I would sneak out together until dawn, transfixed and also confused by the sensual responses the dancers awoke in us, feelings we didn't yet have names for. I had changed many times since those days, my skin shed again and again. I would still know Lakwait if she crept out of the shadows to stand in the firelight. But would she recognize me? On her veranda, Karen had hung two blazing beacons, ship's lanterns that she'd once brought back from Denmark for Barclay, and which had been returned to her after his death. Watching the Ngoma a distance away, Dennis stood under one of these, his weight on one foot, and his other foot cocked, his shoulder resting on a blue fieldstone pillar. Mansfield stood near the other, the two of them arranged as symmetrically as doorways into two different worlds. I couldn't help but be struck by the thought that fate might have lined things up differently. In some other time, or on another plane, Dennis might have been my husband, and this child been his child. I'd have felt differently about everything then, happy and excited about the future, instead of worried and sad. But here and now, the die was cast. Even, God help me, if some hidden part of me was still waiting for Dennis to love me, to turn from Karen and claim me for his own. What did that matter? It wasn't to be. I looked away from both men, and back towards the fire, where the flames rose, copper and gold, blaze blue and white, the sparks thrown up and raining down again, like the ashes of fallen stars. A few days later, I found myself rapping at the door of Ruta and Kamaru's hut. After the day's work was done, their kitchen smelled of spices and stewed meat. Arsis was now 4 years old, with his father's high, square forehead, and his confidence, too. He liked to stand on the beaten earth floor by the table and leap as high into the air as he possibly could.
looking so like Kabi, it could stop my heart.
He will be an excellent Moran, don't you think?
Kimaru asked.
He'll be perfect, I agreed,
and then finally confessed to Ruta that I would soon have a child too.
Yes, Beru, he said lightly.
Of course he already knew. It had been ridiculous of me to think he hadn't.
And our sons will play together, as we did, will they not?
They will, I agreed. Maybe they'll even hunt. We both remember how.
I do.
A Moran never forgets, he replied.
You're my family, Ruta. You and Arsis. And Kimaru, too. I hope you know that. He nodded, his eyes rich and black. I had the feeling that if I looked deeply enough into them, I would see all the years of our childhood played out one marvelous day at a time. And in that moment, I felt the faintest stirrings of hope about this baby. None of it would be easy, but if Ruta was here to remind me of who I really was, it might be all right. I would still have to weather England and Mansfield's mother without him, but come the summer, we'd bring the baby home. Melela would be my son's Green Hills. If I thought of it that way, the future wasn't nearly so terrifying.
What does your father say? Ruta asked.
He doesn't know yet.
Ah, he said,
and then repeated a Swahili phrase he'd challenged me with years before.
A new thing is good, though it be a sore place.
So I've heard, I said, and left him to his dinner. Chapter 53. Confinement is one of those funny old-fashioned words that say so much more than they mean to. I had mine in Swiftston, with Mansfield's mother, who made everything easy for me in one way, and a personalized piece of hell in another. I slept in a beautiful room, and had a lady's maid, and didn't lift a finger even to pour my own tea. It was obvious she meant to lavish this child with everything befitting a Markham. I wasn't really a Markham myself, and she made that expressly clear, all without saying a word. I sailed from Mombasa alone, leaving Ruta and my father in charge of the horses. Mansfield joined me in January, and was there for the birth on 25 February 1929. A day so bitterly cold, the pipes clanged and threatened to burst in the nursing home in Eaton Square. The windows to the street had glazed over, blanketing out the world, and I found myself fixing on that opaque smear as I bore down. I had been given laughing gas and some sort of sedative. Both made me shake and believe I might snap into pieces. Clutching, strangling pains came in rhythms I had no control over. My knees shook. My hands quivered on the damp sheets. Hours later, with a final sickening push, Jarvis fell out of my body. I craned to see him, and won only the briefest glimpse of his puckered face, the tiny chest slick with blood, before the doctors took him away. I was still lurching in the grip of the drugs. I had no idea what was happening, and could only lie there, prodded by the nurses to hold still. No one was telling me anything, not why they'd taken my baby, or if he was even alive. I struggled with the nurses, and then slapped one, and finally they sedated me. When I came to, Mansfield was in my room, looking waxen and drawn. The baby wasn't right, he began to explain. He was dangerously small, and he was missing things that should be there. The anus hadn't ever formed, nor the rectum.
What?
I still felt thick and sedated.
How?
The doctors say it happens sometimes.
He'd been biting at his lip again. I could see a pale,
lilac-colored bruise blooming.
But what if the riding did it, Beryl?
Could it have? Is that what you think?
Mother's sure it couldn't have helped things.
Oh. His words thudded at the back of my skull. What can they do for him?
There's surgery. If he's strong enough, there might be several, actually. But he's not strong now. He's so small. His breathing isn't good. They're saying we should prepare for the worst.
When Mansfield left my room, I gathered the sheets and blankets around me, but couldn't begin to feel warm. Our son might die. The very thought had me shaking again, lost and sick and utterly helpless. In my Larkwaite days, I was at the Kip Shamba once, when a maimed child was born. It had a small stump where one of the legs should have been, the skin pink and raw, puzzle-stitched. No one tried to shield any of this tragedy from Kibi or me. The child would either live or it wouldn't. It was up to their god. That night the mother placed the babe just outside the door to her hut and slept, as the rest of the tribe did, without answering its cries. The theory went that if the oxen didn't trample it, the child was meant to live. But that night a predator came and took it away, probably a leopard or hyena. That was thought to be the god's will, too. Would Jarvis make it through his surgery, or even his first night? Was some god going to punish me by taking him? Or did everything that happened to us on Earth come down to a blind roll of clicking dice, without any more reason or plan than chance? I wasn't sure what I believed, and had never learned to pray. I didn't know how to surrender to fate, either. So I hummed an old African song under my breath as I waited, one full of thin courage. Kali Kama Simba, Sisi Askari, Wote Ni Hadari. Fierce like the lion are we. Soldiers all are brave. Chapter 54. Astonishingly, Jarvis survived his first precarious days of life. The doctors attached a strange sort of bag to his belly and fed him through tiny snaking tubes in his nose. He gained an ounce and then lost two. He came down with jaundice and they put him under bright lamps. For the most part, we were kept from him because he couldn't be exposed to even the faintest risk of germs. I saw him only twice as I recuperated in the nursing home, and both times I felt punched in the heart. He was so frail and defenseless, like a broken bird. On the day before Jarvis's surgery, Mansfield came to my room, looking pale and defeated.
I know it's too soon to be talking about all of this, but if he makes it, I want Jarvis to go to Swifton for his recovery. Mother can make sure he gets the very best care.
Of course, if the doctors approve it.
For myself, I hated Swifton, but Jarvis came first.
And what will you do, he went on, when you're released from the hospital?
What do you mean? I want to be where Jarvis is, obviously.
I assumed you'd want to go back home.
One day, yes, when we can all go together. What is this about, Mansfield?
He turned and went to the window, pacing before it, his feet stitching the dark floorboards. The weather was still terrible, and all the panes were rimed over with greenish-looking ice that gave Mansfield's skin a ghostly cast. He looked different to me now that we'd come to England, not just more pallid, but weaker in spirit, too. Almost as if he were reverting to his boyhood self, that invalid who'd spent most of his youth in bed, poring over the Latin names of flowers.
I'm not sure I'll go back to Kenya, he said. It seems more and more clear how different we are. I feel a little foolish about it. Foolish to marry me? Why are you saying this now? We've made a life together. Do you mean to throw it away? I wanted a new chance. I did. But maybe I was just playing a role. Or you were. I felt the room lurch. I don't understand. The farm is my whole life. And we have Jarvis now. We're bound to him. I know that, he said wearily. Then he went to talk to the doctor, while everything we'd said, and hadn't, hung in the room like a cold, crimped fog. I could scarcely catch up. Mansfield and I had been at odds sometimes, and had never been an ideal match, but we'd wanted the same things, and had been friends. Now any affection seemed to have dissolved as quickly as the sun had. It was a different season here, in more ways than one. While I was still fretting over all of this, I heard a flurry of footsteps outside the door. I assumed Mansfield had returned with news from the doctor. But it was Prince Harry who'd come. "You're supposed to be on safari," I said, taking in the shock of him. His fine grey suit looked as if it had been drawn onto his body. He didn't belong in a nursing home on Gerald Road. "Everything was postponed. I imagine you've been too caught up here to know. But my father developed a lung infection. It was a do-or-die situation, but he's recovered. What of you? I didn't even know you were expecting. And then there you were in the Times. One son born to Markham, Beryl, at Gerald Road. You're a wily one."
I wasn't ready for anyone to know. Now the baby's in trouble too.
I felt my face crumpling, and wondered if I were about to cry in front of royalty. Would that appear in the Times too? "I'm sorry. I heard. What can I do?"
"If you really want to help, you can make sure the surgeon is the very best. You must know who's good around here, and who can be trusted. He's still so small. Did you see him?"
Harry shook his head, just as two nurses came in and pretended to busy themselves with linens. Obviously they were addled by having royalty in their midst and wanted a closer view. "I'm happy to look into the surgeon," he said, ignoring them. "And please don't hesitate to ring me if you need anything else, anything at all."
"Thank you. I'm so worried."
"Of course you are." He reached for my hand and squeezed it, and then leaned over and pressed his lips to the back of my wrist. It was a harmless gesture, meant only to show concern, but the nurses turned and gaped. Their square caps tipped towards us like flowers, or like megaphones. Chapter 55. Weak as he was, Jarvis had the heart of a young Moran. He made it through that first surgery in the middle of March, and was a little more whole afterwards. They created an opening in him where there'd been only a blank expanse of skin. The next month, he had another operation to form a rectum out of tissue from his colon, and then yet another, to bring it all together, like dots connecting in a child's crude puzzle book. Each time, we didn't know if he'd survive the procedure or the anesthesia. There was always the risk of sepsis afterwards, and hemorrhage, and shock. The doctors had said no to Swithston for the moment. He remained in hospital, while Mansfield and I stayed at the Grosvenor, though in separate suites. We weren't talking about the fate of our marriage for the moment. We were barely speaking at all. One day, Ginger Birkbeck came to visit me at the hotel. She and Ben were in London because she needed surgery for a benign tumor in some female region of her body she was far too delicate to name. But she didn't want to talk about that anyway, but about Harry.
"Tongues are wagging all over town about you two," she told me. "Word is that you're at the Grosvenor because it's across the road from Buckingham Palace, and that he comes and goes from your suite through a passageway along the basement."
That's absurd. We're only good friends, and he's been awfully kind to me.
Even so, you should take care. It's quite a serious thing. Forgive me for saying so, but your reputation hasn't exactly been spotless. And the gossip columns always jump to the easiest conclusion.
Let them then. I just don't care anymore.
So you are involved with Harry?
Whose bloody business is it if I am, or if I'm not?
I paced the plush carpet, green tones and red tones all clashed together in a muddle of Christmas and Sotheby's.
My God, but I was tired.
Ginger's eyes widened. From her seat on my sofa, she asked,
You're not planning to say either way, then?
You're missing the point. I'm trying to tell you it doesn't matter. No one's going to believe me if I deny the rumors anyway.
You could be ruined, Beryl, she said. Have you thought of that?
I closed my eyes and opened them again. Honestly, if I could have my life back and be left alone, I'm not sure I'd mind that much.
I'm trying to help, you know. I only want what's best for you.
Believe it or not, so do I.
There were a series of raps on the door, and Harry walked in with his lovely haircut and sharp, piney cologne and his knife-pleated trousers.
Hello, he said. What's happening here? How's Jarvis today?
Stronger, by all accounts.
That's excellent. Really excellent.
He crossed the room swiftly and gave me a squeeze, and then he kissed me on the forehead, while Ginger's cheeks went bright crimson. Finally, in early May, the surgeons were poised to release Jarvis to Swifton. Though I knew I was going to have a fight on my hands, I thought it was time to bring up Kenya, too.
He would never survive the trip,
Mansfield said plainly to me in his brother Charles's coldly lavish library in Connaught Square. Not now, obviously. But next year?
I'm not going back. Not with the way things are. And Jarvis will have a better life here.
How can you uproot all of us without even considering another way?
You can do whatever you like, he said without emotion. I'm only thinking of Jarvis now. He'll have constant care from nurses, nannies, and the best surgeons on hand.
He's never going to be a strong child. You heard the doctor.
I have, actually. I've heard everything the doctors have been saying.
I caught his eyes pointedly.
Do you know Jarvis's illness could have happened to anyone? That my riding had nothing whatever to do with it?
A muscle in his jaw convulsed, and he looked away.
It doesn't matter now, does it?
No, I don't suppose it does. For weeks I had been tortured by guilt, thinking my actions had done Jarvis harm. But in the end, placing blame on either side was pointless. His future would come down to power and resources. Mansfield's mother had never liked me. She would push to shut me out of my son's life, and Mansfield had grown so severe and close to me. The door between us had become a wall, and Jarvis was on the other side.
He's my child, too. How is it I have no rights, no say?
He shrugged, pursing his lips.
You've brought everything on yourself. Now there are rumors this child is the Duke's.
But that's ludicrous. I was pregnant in June. Harry didn't even arrive in Kenya until October, when I was months gone.
Harry? David?
The rumors fly both ways. Honestly, Beryl, one prince wasn't enough for you. You had to try for two.
I would have slapped him if I'd had any strength left for outrage.
This gossip disgusts me.
So deny the claims.
I shouldn't have to, especially not to you.
And what does it matter what people think anymore?
Damn them all!
We went on in this way, while the servants crouched, no doubt, just outside the door, ready to reveal everything to the tattler. Mansfield was trying to strong-arm me into making a clearing statement to the Times. His mother was very nearly beside herself over the scandal.
Think of her good name, Mansfield implored. Propriety means everything here. I'm so sick of things done in the name of propriety.